You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we're approaching peak season for yellow jackets. We'll talk to a Wisconsin expert on insects about how they do more good stuff than we might think. First, an oil pipeline operated by the energy firm Enbridge is facing legal actions on two fronts, from the state of Michigan and from Upper Wisconsin's Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. The tribe is hoping the company shuts down its Line 5, which runs through the reservation along the shores of Lake Superior. Enbridge has said it's open to rerouting the pipeline outside of the tribe's land. Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. Danny, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
You've been following this pipeline for a while. Can you give us a reminder of where this Line 5 runs and what it does?
Yeah, Line 5 is a pipeline that carries up to 540,000 barrels of natural gas liquids and crude oil per day from Superior to Sarnia, Ontario. And that path of the pipe goes, it splits into dual pipelines as it crosses under the lake through the Straits of Mackinac, which connects Lakes Michigan and Huron.
And last week, we hear the tribe took legal action, the Bad River Band took legal action against Enbridge. What are they seeking in this lawsuit?
Well, they want to see the pipeline shut down immediately. They feel that it is a risk to the Bad River and Lake Superior and their reservation. So they want to see the line shut down immediately.
You talked to some tribal members and leaders about Line 5. Here's a listen to Bad River Tribal Council member Dylan Jennings.
What people really, really should understand is the constant fear and anxiety that our community has had to endure, stemming from years of constant, you know, unknown and threats that the line poses.
What are some of the specific threats that the tribe has raised?
Well, the tribal members there have said that the river is changing and that conditions on the river are causing a meander or an oxbow, where basically it's eroding away a riverbank that is close to the pipeline. And back in the 60s, it was further away, like 320 feet or so, and now it is within 30 feet of that pipeline, threatening to expose it and leave it unsupported and opening it up to other stresses like, you know, flooding that they have seen on the Bad River and other issues like debris in that river.
Talking to WPR reporter Danielle Kading based in Superior, talking about an Enbridge pipeline through the state and legal action challenging that pipeline from a northern Wisconsin tribe and from the state of Michigan. Now, in response to what's coming from the tribe here, Danielle, what is the company, what is Enbridge saying about this?
Enbridge has said that, you know, they've been operating this pipeline safely through the reservation since 1953, and that they have been in mediation since the easements for certain tracts of the line expired in 2013. They say that for the majority of the line that runs through the reservation, that they continue to have a right-of-way or easements on that that won't expire until 2043. They are hoping for a solution, and they have even said that they would be willing to reroute the pipeline outside of Bad River's reservation.
Has the Bad River tribe responded to that concept of their Enbridge's idea of rerouting the line?
Yeah, they have, and they're not having it. They want the pipeline removed immediately from the watershed. It's not acceptable for them to have it rerouted directly outside of the reservation because they say it would still impact water resources, and so they're opposed to that as well.
As we mentioned, that's one of the lawsuits. We're also hearing action from the state of Michigan. What's happening there?
Yeah, in the state of Michigan, Attorney General Dana Nessel there has started legal action to decommission the pipeline. She was threatening to sue as the administration, Governor Gretchen Whitmer, was trying to negotiate with Enbridge to find a way to get the aging pipeline, which is 66 years old, out of the straits because they're worried that it's susceptible to an anchor strike and other stresses that could possibly spill oil into the Great Lakes. So they want that old line out as soon as possible. They had been trying to come to an agreement. Enbridge had proposed this $500 million tunnel construction deal, which would create a tunnel where a new pipeline would be housed within that. But from Michigan's point of view, that would not happen fast enough. You know, their original timeline for that project was around 10 years. They said that that's too much time to have this aging pipeline in the Great Lakes. And later, Enbridge came back and said, well, we can do it in 5, but really, they just want to see that pipeline removed as quickly as possible and are now it's in the courts.
Where is this oil actually coming from? I know it flows into Superior and then out through this Line 5. What's the ultimate source of it?
Canada. It's a Canadian energy firm, Enbridge is. And so all of the oil that comes through that line comes from Canada to Superior and goes through its lines, as well as the natural gas that comes from Superior as well.
What are the alternative ways to transport it? You touched on this a little bit in your reporting.
Yeah.
There's pipelines which have their risks, but the other alternatives have risks as well.
Yeah, there have been a couple of studies or reports that have come out about, you know, other alternatives to moving crude oil or natural gas liquids, and they have mixed results. One study by London Economics International, which was commissioned by the National Wildlife Federation, says that, you know, if they were to do this by trucking, it would be around $1.31 more per barrel than using Line 5, and that cost increase would be just lost in the typical noise of crude oil volatility. Another analysis commissioned by the state of Michigan found that moving by truck or barge was not viable or feasible, so it had alternative results on that, and it said that rail transportation was probably the most practical and cost-effective of the three alternatives, but with rail transportation comes more risk, and it should be noted that a lot of that risk would be seen more in Wisconsin than it would be in Michigan.
What are you watching for next with these various legal challenges? What's the timeline for when we could see action on these?
When it's in the legal system, I don't know if you can predict that. It seems like a lot of these court battles have been long and drawn out, which is why Enbridge is pushing, at least in the state of Michigan, for the tunnel project to move that forward, because they see that as the quickest way to get that aging pipeline out of the Great Lakes. As far as Bad River is concerned, they want to see that line removed from their reservation lands. And I guess it's anyone's guess how long this will take and if it's going to continue through the justice system.
And as we speak and as it waits for court action, the oil and natural gas is still flowing, right?
It's still flowing. Yep, up to 540,000 barrels per day.
Danny, thanks a lot for bringing us up to speed.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, WPR reporter based in Superior. She was with us for an update on Enbridge's Line 5 after the company was sued by the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, also a lawsuit, as we heard, from the state of Michigan. Coming up, yellow jackets are a summertime nuisance, but they do some good stuff, too. We'll find out more from a Wisconsin expert on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's yellow jacket season here in Wisconsin, but the insects might not be as bad as we think they are. We'll learn about some of the good things they can do for us. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a visit to a summer celebration.
Wisconsin is known for throwing cultural and church festivals all summer long. And today, we're going to talk about one particular celebration, Greek Fest Plus in Madison, hosted every July by Assumption Greek Orthodox Church. Carol Griskovich talked with festival organizers about the history of the annual fest, their food, and the community.
It's my understanding that still, and I was digging into this, that we are the longest running ethnic festival in Madison. It's a Greek Fest Plus because we want to really honor all of the diverse ethnicities in our community. But it's really a reunion. It's a block party. It's a community event. And especially last year, people would come up to me and say they've never felt more welcome at a festival in Madison as they have at Greek Fest.
For many years, this was the only Eastern Christian church in this part of Wisconsin. And so as a consequence, all the Orthodox people from all over the world who lived in central and southern Wisconsin came here to this church, and they still do.
Jason, yeah. Happy birthday to your father.
Oh, yeah, I didn't even say that yet.
Well, the church was started, it was
incorporated with the state of Wisconsin in 1951, and it was a group of primarily Greek immigrants that relocated here in the Madison area that began the church.
My grandfather came at age 16 with some male relatives, and they began working on the railroad. They settled in Madison and opened up a restaurant, the Coney Island. First, it was located, I believe, on the 2nd block of State Street, and then later it moved to the 300 block of State Street.
Oh, should we just get like a variety pack?
Hi. Can I have 4 baklava, please?
And we brought back this year the traditional Coney dog, Coney Island dog, which is how so many of the Greek immigrants made their living coming to America. And they brought with them the secret, the spices and the cumin and the cinnamon and to add to this puree sauce that gets spooned over a hot dog. I'm going to leave one spice out, just so no one knows. We've got cayenne, cloves, cinnamon, of course, oregano, of course, paprika, allspice, and a mystery spice. Garlic powder, onion powder, butter. Actually, butter is what caught me off guard with the recipe. It's like it's going to give it a really kind of a thick richness. We're going to cook it down so it's thick. We're going to puree it, so it's not chili sauce. This is Coney sauce. It's very specific to Greek immigrants.
Have you sampled the Coney sauce that we are using during Greek Fest? Because from what I have been told, we're using your father's recipe.
I have not, because I have never been fond. Isn't that terrible? Our bread and butter, and I was never fond of the chili sauce.
That's who we are as the church, who we are as Orthodox Christians. That familial bond that we already have through our worship is just transferred out into the celebration of our ethnic heritage and bringing of all of these people together. 2 days of this huge festival that just brings our excitement for one another out.
That was Georgiana Wilton, Father Michael Vanderhoof, David Giffey, and Patty Notes. Music by Rhythmos and Sergei Belkin. That story was brought to us by WPT's Carol Griskovich, who is also a member of the church. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, if you've got any outdoor cookouts or picnics or festivals on your calendar for the rest of the summer, you might have a run-in with yellow jackets. The stinging insect is reaching peak season here in Wisconsin, and despite being one of the most disliked parts of summer, it might actually do some good for us. PJ Leash is the director of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. PJ, thanks for being with us.
Sure, pleasure to be here.
All right, so yellow jackets. People look at them and they see the yellow and black, and I think most of our minds think bees. Yellow jackets are not bees, right?
Correct, yes. They're from the same general group, the order Hymenoptera, which includes bees, wasps, ants, and creatures called sawflies. So they're distantly related but different twigs in that same branch in the tree of life.
So they're closer to the hornets and wasps, is that right?
Yes, they're within that wasp group.
And how many kinds of yellow jackets do we have here in the state?
Yeah, so in Wisconsin, the upper Midwest, we have over a dozen different species, and they have slight differences in appearance, habits, habitat that they prefer to nest in, and so on.
Let's get into the main reason I wanted to talk to you today. I've gone through most of my life thinking yellow jackets are a nuisance and useless for everything, nature, humans, and the like. And I keep hearing stuff that suggests that I've been wrong all along. Can you talk about the role yellow jackets can play?
Sure. So I suppose if we went onto the sidewalk and asked most folks their impression, it's probably going to be a negative impression. I will admit, I kind of grew up thinking the same thing. Mm-hmm. You disturb them, they sting you. They certainly can do that. They can do a lot of beneficial things. And when I think of yellow jackets, overall, I think of them being more beneficial than harmful. I think it boils down to location of the nest. If it's right outside your front door, you know, that's a concern. Otherwise, in terms of the beneficial things that they can do some pollination. Turns out, especially late in the season, yellow jacket workers are looking specifically for carbohydrate sources. They're running low on fuel, so to speak, so they need sugar sources. That may mean nectar from flowers. If you look at them under a microscope, their middle body region, the thorax, it actually has a fairly fuzzy and hairy appearance, and pollen will cling to that. They have not evolved specifically for pollination, that bees have, but if they're visiting one flower for nectar and going to another one, they're going to do some pollination. So they can do pollination. That's one thing. I think of them mostly, though, being predators, and they can be really pretty darn good predators. They're very fond of kind of soft, squishier insects, if you will. They're very fond of attacking things like caterpillar, maybe sawfly larvae and things like that. And the reason they act as predators is they need a protein source to take back to the nest. That's what they're feeding to their young. Their young are developing and growing. They need that protein input, whereas the adults need more of a carbohydrate fuel source to burn through.
So as part of our yellow jacket PR here, do they prey upon things that might be, say, garden nuisances?
Yes, absolutely.
So what kind of things? The ones you just mentioned?
Well, I mean, yeah, if you wander out in your garden, we have various cutworm caterpillars, hornworms, and things like that that may be around. I will say, though, sometimes they can almost do too good of a job. And what I mean by that is if you are specifically doing something like butterfly gardening, and these days we hear a lot about folks growing milkweed for monarch caterpillars, or you can grow other plants to attract other butterflies and get their caterpillars. And if you have a very active yellow jacket or paper wasp nest nearby, they might come in and essentially pick off all of those caterpillars. So they can almost be too good of a predator in that regard.
Okay, I am actually doing that. I have all sorts of volunteer milkweed. So I thought, okay, I'll plant some other monarch-friendly plants around it. So I haven't seen yellow jackets in that zone. If I do, maybe those are a nuisance there for me.
Yeah, they might be doing a little bit of harm from the caterpillar's standpoint in a case like that. Because again, they are very, very good predators. They need that protein to take back to feed to the nest.
Let's talk a little more about yellow jacket behavior. You say they like sugar, especially late in the season. I think we've all probably had the experience of drinking a soda outside or a beer outside. Why are they after our beverages?
Yeah. So reason for it, you actually have to look at their entire life cycle or biology. And our yellow jackets, they start from scratch every year. They overwinter as fertilized queens. So when the queens try to establish a colony in the spring, at first, it's just her. She's got to do all the work. She lays eggs, raises batches of workers. Over time, the colony keeps getting bigger and bigger. The queen is then going to be staying in the nest laying eggs, whereas those workers and that expanding workforce, they're the ones going out to collect food to bring back to the colony. Well, by the time we get to late summer, the colony is at peak size, and also some of their food sources, insect prey, other sugar sources outdoors, are starting to dry up. So you have maximum population in the nest. Food sources are starting to run low. So they get really desperate. And that's often, you know, around the time of football season and things like that. And so that's why folks that are out tailgating with soda or beer, you get the yellow jackets coming into those.
Anecdotally, I seem to remember my yellow jacket stings over the years are concentrated late summer into early fall. Is there a reason for that?
Well, again, I think it just has to do with the fact that that's the period of peak population size for the year. Once you get later into the fall, they're essentially starving to death. And also when the frost comes, that takes them out. So by the time we get into November, December, those colonies have essentially died out for the year.
Are they more ornery too, or is it just that there's more of them out there looking further afield maybe for food?
Yeah, they may be a little bit more aggressive that time of the year because, again, they are desperate, searching for just about anything that they can look for. And again, the colony is at peak size. So you've got a lot of workers out there looking for food sources.
Now, that overwintering compared to bees, do I have this right? More bees would survive through the winter. You'd have a bunch of them living as opposed to yellow jackets. You're saying there's one.
Yeah, well, and even then, it depends on the type of bee.
Okay.
If you think of something like a honeybee, they spend the winter together as a colony. So you got hundreds or thousands in there. With some of our other bees, like bumblebees, do almost the same thing as yellow jackets. And what I mean by that is the bulk of the colony dies out late in the season. And then you have certain females, and these are females that have gone out from the nest, mated, so they're ready to lay eggs. Those females seek out a sheltered overwintering spot. Could be a tucked away area inside a rotting log or something like that. They're going to overwinter there, and then those females have to start new nests or try to start new nests from scratch the following spring.
Getting back to the ecosystem, yellow jackets are predators. Are they also prey for somebody?
To a certain extent, yes. if you think of a yellow jacket nest, it can be pretty well defended. But if you were a large mammal, perhaps with thick fur, fairly tolerant, I mean, if you can get into a nest, that's a good protein source. The larvae, essentially these little grub-like creatures, I mean, that's kind of a jackpot for a foraging mammal. A skunk or something like that might feed on those.
They can be a nuisance to many of us. Of course, some people have serious allergies to bee stings. Do yellow jacket stings trigger the same response for people?
They may, and there's going to be some differences in the actual chemicals in the venom. And venom itself, it's not a single thing. It's kind of a chemical soup, a mixture of a number of different things. In general, if someone has sting concerns with bees, they probably are going to be pretty wary of yellow jackets as well, just because of some of the same concerns.
Big picture, you said you grew up like I did, worried about the yellow jacket. It sounds like you're saying, hey, maybe they're not such bad guys overall.
Right, yeah. And in general, if you give them a wide berth and stay away from the nest, they tend to leave you alone. If you get up close within, you know, a few feet, or you run over that ground nest with the lawnmower, they're going to be defensive. They're going to come out and sting. But if it's a nest in the back corner of your yard and you can kind of leave it alone and it's going to die out naturally in the fall, they're providing free pest control for you around your garden and flower bed.
And finally, if we have one in that place, the doorway, or some, they're next to our house and we know somebody's allergic to bee stings, what are the best ways to deal with those if we have to?
Good question. It depends on where the nest is located. If we have an exposed nest, so that aerial paper mache type nest, we can easily treat that with an aerosol spray can from the hardware store. The caveat is some of the species will nest in pre-existing cavities. So this might be up in your soffit area of your home, or it might be in a spot such as a chipmunk burrow in the ground. It turns out for those locations, the aerosol sprays don't work very well because the droplets settle. And so if you went out and were to spray that ground nest, it might take out some of the workers, but you check the next day and they're back. So it's often most helpful in those cases, if need be, and you can't avoid leaving it alone, to use a dust or powder type product that is labeled, and the instructions say you can use it on ground nesting yellow jackets.
PJ, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure. Pleasure to be here.
PJ Leish is director of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. He was with us to talk about some of the good things that yellow jackets do as they reach their peak in late summer. Coming up, Attorney General William Barr has directed the Department of Justice to reinstate the death penalty at the federal level. We'll look at what led to that decision. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 7 on The Morning Show, cars, pedestrians, bicycles, and now a lot of scooters. Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at all the different people and vehicles that use roads and sidewalks and the politics behind the pavement. That's tomorrow at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, Attorney General William Barr directed the Federal Bureau of Prisons to schedule and resume executions at the federal level for inmates on death row. It would be the first time in roughly 16 years that the federal government has executed an inmate. The federal death penalty was established in 1988. Only three death row inmates have been executed between then and 2003, according to the Death Penalty Information Center. If Barr's mandate proceeds, five inmates would be executed beginning in December. Opponents of the death penalty point to issues like faulty evidence and racial bias in death penalty cases. Those in favor argue that the families and victims are owed justice. Austin Serrett is the William Nelson Cromwell Professor of Jurisprudence and Political Science at Amherst College. He's the author of the book Gruesome Spectacles, Botched Executions and America's Death Penalty. Austin, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Talk about the federal death penalty. It's been on hold. We never officially got rid of it, but it's been on hold for a number of years. Why is that?
Well, it's been on hold for a couple of reasons. After the botched execution of Clayton Lockett in Oklahoma in 2014, that was a state execution, not a federal execution, Barack Obama asked the Justice Department to do a comprehensive study of capital punishment at the federal level and directed them not to go forward with any executions during the time when that study was being done. There was also a question about whether the federal government could obtain the drugs necessary to carry out a lethal injection.
And that's part of the change here now from the Justice Department. They're moving toward using one particular drug that's being used in some states instead of a, I believe, combination of three different execution drugs. Is that right?
That's right. Their proposal is to move to a one-drug protocol away from the three-drug protocol. And one-drug protocols are in use in, I think, three states. They are somewhat controversial. It's not a proven and reliable way of carrying out a lethal injection.
Do we have a sense as to why the Justice Department is looking at bringing the death penalty back now?
Well, if you take Attorney General Barr's words on their face, he said they're doing it to vindicate the claims of the rule of law. The federal statutes allow for the death penalty, and he says in going forward with them, what he's doing is vindicating those statutes. But I think there's something else that's certainly in play, and that is by resuming the federal death penalty, what Barr and President Trump are doing is, I think, seen more really through the lens of politics as a better way of understanding it than through the lens of law. I think they're starting the federal death penalty again or restarting it in order to provide a kind of red meat to Trump's base.
Now, we've seen a big trend away from the death penalty in states around the country, including along with that federal hiatus in the death penalty. One reason, the botched executions that you mentioned, and we can get into that more. Also, concerns about racial bias and innocent people, in hindsight, having been executed. Can you talk about some of the trends that have led to more states turning away from the death penalty?
Sure. I think the national conversation about capital punishment has changed and changed dramatically in the last couple of decades. The conversation about capital punishment has moved away from what I would call abstract philosophical questions and towards really examining the practical realities of the way the death penalty is carried out. Increasingly, I think, at the state level and really reflected in national public opinion polls, people are concerned that whatever the merits of the death penalty in some abstract philosophical conversation, the ways in which it is carried out violate or conflict with some important American values. So if you look at the death penalty system up close, what you find is that more than 150 people have been sent to death row and then subsequently exonerated. There's real evidence that race plays an important role in who gets death sentences. And then what we know is that the technologies of executing people are unreliable. So you can be in favor of the death penalty, but say I'm against executing people who are innocent, or you can be in favor of the death penalty, but say I'm against executing people because of their race or the race of the victim. And more, I think those practical realities are carrying the national conversation about capital punishment.
Talking to Austin Sarrett from Amherst College, looking at the federal government, the Justice Department move to bring back the death penalty at the federal level. We heard from Gina on Facebook, who says her opinion has changed over time when it comes to the death penalty. Gina says, I supported capital punishment until I recognized that the system isn't infallible, being that it's comprised of humans, and the fact that communities and people of color are policed, charged, and sentenced with a much heavier hand. This wasn't a recent revelation, to be clear, Gina says. And that reflects the trend that you were just talking about, doesn't it?
That's absolutely right. And there's substantial evidence that the problem of race or racial bias, which we know to play an important role at the state level, also has in the past affected federal death sentencing. Between 1995 and 2000, roughly 80% of all federal capital cases that were recommended by United States attorney to the attorney general seeking authorization to go forward with a death penalty were those cases were brought against people of color. And today, 42%, roughly 42% of the inmates on the federal death row are African American. So the issue of race is as present and problematic at the level of the federal death penalty as it has been at the level of the death penalty in the states.
In making this announcement, the Justice Department highlighted five individuals, people who would likely be executed, and detailed fairly heinous crimes. We heard from Missy on Facebook, who says, when someone goes in and shoots an area full of people, terrorists, premeditated murders, serial killers, people who starve or kill children and elderly, Missy writes, they'll never rehabilitate. They don't deserve to live. They had a chance at life. They chose the wrong route. Why should they live? Why should we pay to house them? They had a choice, Missy says. And that's not an uncommon attitude. There's still, in some polls, at least a majority of Americans do support capital punishment in some cases.
That's right. The public support for the death penalty, roughly about 54% of the American public favors the death penalty. And again, the way in which your listener has expressed it, I think is very powerful and very important. The question is not what someone deserves in a kind of, again, abstract moral or philosophical sense. The question is, what do we do when we punish? Do we want to have a system of execution which risks executing the innocent? Do we want to have a system of capital punishment which seems to fall disproportionately on racial minorities? And there's a kind of irony for the federal government, especially for conservatives who have for a long time advocated that we respect the states and what they would call states' rights, in that six of the people on federal death row, of the 62 who are on federal death row, committed their crimes in states that themselves do not have a death penalty. So when the federal government goes into a place like that, what the federal government is doing is imposing on the values and beliefs of the people of those states, which states have rejected capital punishment.
And that's an interesting point. Here in Wisconsin, we don't have the death penalty, but this is still an issue for us because, hypothetically at least, someone could be sentenced to capital punishment in a federal court here in Wisconsin. Is that right?
That is exactly right. I live in Massachusetts. Massachusetts is also a state that doesn't have the death penalty. Two of the people presently on the federal death row were tried and sentenced to death in a federal court in the state of Massachusetts.
Talking to Austin Sarrett right now about the decision to reinstate the death penalty at the federal level. He's a professor of jurisprudence and political science at Amherst College. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the federal government moving to carry out executions starting toward the end of this year? Are you for or against the death penalty, against capital punishment? What questions do you have our guest about the past and present and maybe future of capital punishment? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about the decision to reinstate the federal death penalty with Austin Sarrett, professor of jurisprudence and political science at Amherst College. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the death penalty? What do you think about the attorney general's decision to bring it back at the federal level? Do you support it? Why or why not? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Austin, you mentioned that part of the reason people turned against the death penalty was partly because of concern over botched executions. You've written a whole book about this. Can you talk about why we initially moved to lethal injections compared to what we'd had before? First hanging and then, I believe, the electric chair.
So if you look at the history of the American death penalty going back to the beginning of the 20th century, you could roughly say that what the United States has done is to try to find a method of execution that would be safe, reliable, and humane. The electric chair was thought to be safer, more reliable, and more humane than hanging. The gas chamber was thought to be safer, more reliable, and a better technology than the electric chair. And in the late 1970s, lethal injection was brought in as, a substitute which was thought to be better than the others. The same promises have been made about the electric chair, about the gas chamber, and then about lethal injection. And each one of them has been shown to be deeply flawed. It's as if we're looking for a kind of technological magic bullet that would allow us to use the death penalty and do so in a way that is compatible with the Constitution's prohibition of cruel and unusual punishment. We haven't yet found that technology, and I'm not sure that we're ever going to.
Let's bring on a caller now. Lou is with us in Green Bay. Lou, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
Well, I was just wanting to touch on what the guest was talking about as far as racial and political motivations for capital punishment. And I was just wondering if those numbers are somewhat skewed or disingenuous as far as being disproportionate, but only because there's also a disproportionate number of crimes within a certain ethnicity and, being represented as being something that is targeted due to race is kind of, I think, maybe not following the data correctly.
Lou, thanks for the call. Lou saying, I guess, if a particular group, in this case, African-Americans, commit more crimes, it's not a disparity if more end up on death row, Austin.
Well, African-Americans do not commit 80% of the murders in the United States. If 80% of the cases that are referred for a death penalty in the federal system are directed against African-Americans, it's not because they're committing that percentage of the crimes. And actually, studies have shown that the best predictor of whether or not someone will get a death sentence, everything else to the contrary notwithstanding, is the race of their victim. You're much more likely to get a death sentence, regardless of your race, if you murder a white person, much more likely to have that happen than if you murder a person of color. So I don't think this is really just a matter of a proportion in relationship to a crime rate. I think the evidence is really quite compelling that the death penalty is imposed disproportionately for racial reasons.
Thanks for that call. One argument, Austin, people used to make, I don't know that I've heard it as much anymore, is that the death penalty acts as a deterrent for future crimes. Do we have evidence one way or the other on that?
Well, the deterrence argument has been a longstanding one, as you indicated. There are some statistical studies, which suggest that the death penalty is a greater deterrent to crime than life imprisonment without parole. But I think those studies have been really largely discredited. There is no reliable evidence that the death penalty makes us a safer society. Indeed, Wisconsin does not have the death penalty. I dare say the crime rate in Wisconsin is lower than it has been in the state of Illinois, which up until recently did have the death penalty. So I think the deterrence argument, it's appealing at the logical level, but when you actually look at it, it kind of falls apart. For someone to be deterred by a death sentence, they would have to be rationally calculating the chance that they're going to be arrested, the chance that they're going to be prosecuted, and the chance that they're going to be charged with a capital offense. Most of the crimes that end up on death row, I don't think, involve that kind of rational calculus. Someone is just overwhelmed with emotion and carries out a gruesome crime. They're not calculating in some mathematical way the chances that they're going to be caught and prosecuted and sentenced to death.
Talking to Austin Sarrett, professor of jurisprudence and political science at Amherst College, about capital punishment as the Justice Department moves to bring back the death penalty for certain federal inmates on death row. Back to your calls now. Dave is with us in Sussex. Dave, hello.
Hello. Hi. Yeah, when I was younger, I used to believe that the death penalty would be a strong deterrent against serious crimes. But as I get older, I realize that that's really not the case. And you get a little wiser in your older age. And your first caller, I think, stole a little bit of my thunder as far as the injustice across racial divide I think you need to, in order to put any water in those buckets, you need to kind of look at a little more of a comparison on the ratio of people that are committing crimes as opposed to being on death row. But more so, I've been taught through my life that man does not have the right to take the life of another human being. That's left up to God and God alone. So for us to think that we have that right, it's completely wrong, because people do get wrongly accused, and there are fates worse than death.
Dave, thanks for the call. Dave has changed his views over time. Austin ultimately coming down, he says, to a moral argument.
Well, I do think there are people that feel that the death penalty ought to be talked about as a moral argument. That's a complicated argument for people who want to make it. The position of the Catholic Church, hardly thought of as a bastion of left-wing activism, is quite strongly against the death penalty on moral grounds. So I think if you want to think about it that way, surely there are grounds for doubting at the moral level the appropriateness of capital punishment. But as I was suggesting before, I think most of the argument in the United States today is not being carried out at that level. If you look at what's happened to death sentences in the United States, they've dropped dramatically. In 1996, 315 people were sentenced to death in the United States. Last year, it was 43. And I think most of that change is not because people have changed their views about the moral question. I think most of that change is because people have come to realize that whatever our moral beliefs about capital punishment, the ways in which it is administered betrays and threatens important American values.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Nancy with us now in Dallas. Nancy, hi. Nancy, are you there? I don't think we have Nancy. We'll try Ron in Sussex then. Ron, hi.
How you doing?
Good. What do you think, Ron?
I am definitely for the death penalty. I'm 72 years old. I listen to different things, moral ground. Well, the people that perpetrate some of the heinous murders that have gone on, why should there be compassion shown for them? There's no moral way or good way to kill somebody, but firing squad works good. Beheading somebody if you're worried about the guy or gal, whoever, suffering.
Ron, thanks for the call. Austin, Ron, not particularly concerned with the humaneness of capital punishment.
So again, I can understand that view and that way of thinking about the death penalty. And I certainly respect people who are angry and indignant, as we all ought to be, about heinous crimes. But I think there's another thing that we all need to think about, and that is, as a society and as a country, we have a commitment, and that commitment is to the avoidance of cruel and unusual punishment. And that's a kind of test for us. And indeed, one could say that the test of any society is how it responds to evil. And a good society finds a way to respond to evil that doesn't replicate it, that doesn't really just do it again in a different form. It's hard to resist the temptation to punish in ways that make us resemble in some way the people who we are punishing. And I think that's the question that we need to think about with respect to all of our punishments, but especially with respect to capital punishment. We don't burn down the home of an arsonist because they've committed arson. It's not clear to me that justice requires that we should kill those who kill.
Austin, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
That's Austin Sarrett, William Nelson Cromwell Professor of Jurisprudence and Political Science at Amherst College. He's the author of the book Gruesome Spectacles, Botched Executions and America's Death Penalty. Joins us today to talk about Attorney General Barr reinstating the death penalty at the federal level. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll check in on the progress of the Foxconn project 2 years after a deal was reached. And you might remember band or choir classes back in school. Our guest says music education needs to change its tune to be more relevant, engaging, and fun for today's students. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6, do you binge-watch TV shows, maybe even more than you think you oughta? Kate and her guests look at the psychology of binge-watching, and you can share your experiences. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then TV shows about food are all over the place, and there's more in the pipeline. We'll learn why there are so many shows out there these days and what we can expect for the future of the genre. And you can tell us if you have a favorite. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.